Attorney Side presents. Lion.
Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Login, the podcast from the University of Plymouth Computing Society, Termasoc. With me today are Rich Jeffrey.
Hello.
Ben Lee.
Hello.
Our sound man, Chris.
Arriba!
And myself, Dan Cossa. Now, it's rather a short and sweet podcast tonight because we're all running so late and absolutely sod all has happened in the world over the last month. But we do each have some loving and hatings to start us off as usual. Ben, what do you have for us this week?
Well, last couple of weeks, I've been really enjoying getting outside. Now, people who know me probably are slightly puzzled by this, but, you know, last week I went to Bodmin Moor with Lisa, wandered around for a bit, and...
Yeah. Forgot to bring your camera.
Yes, I forgot my camera. I realised at the bus stop in a village that most people have never ever heard of.
Ah, which is in the middle of people who live there.
Well, yeah.
Not even all of them.
Middle of bloody nowhere. I remember I haven't got my camera.
I must say, I was a little you are upset. Looking a little more tanned than usual. You know, it's not just computer radiation that's tanned your skin.
Well, I did have a tan on one side of my body previously because I had a window to one side of the desk. So my arm was in the sunlight all day long. But let's not go there.
He actually came into my room that day proud of the fact that he was burnt down only one side of his body.
Nice.
A hating, please, Ben.
I've been hating being broke.
Oh, that sucks.
Yes. Well, I'm sure Dan knows the feeling, because Dan's always broke.
But I have a job now.
But you're still broke.
I'm still broke.
How's that fun? I actually have quite a lot of money at the moment, but I can't spend any of it, because I need it to open a new account when they finally get around to processing my application. And then most of it will go on rent, but by that point I'll have an overdraft.
I don't believe in a bank that makes you wait to open an account.
Yeah. I don't know why.
Obviously, you don't want your money that much.
Obviously not. I contacted them on Monday about... Well, I applied on Friday, contacted them on Monday, and they said 2 to 3 working days. It's now Friday, so...
Are you going to name chain?
It's Smile.
Ah, yes. Admittedly, they did have a high point when they first came out.
Well, I'm currently with the Co-op Bank, but which is practically the same as Smile, but I'm switching because I don't want them to send me paper anymore. I don't like paper.
And the Co-op don't have an option?
Not that I know of.
Halifax is the best thing, where you can set it up so they won't send you your normal statements, but there's no option to turn off your credit card statement.
Brilliant.
So you halve the amount of mail you get, but that's it, I'm afraid. Anyway, before we dwell too long on Britain's banking systems, Rich.
Okay, I know this is going to be a blatantly obvious one, but it has been a few weeks since we last did a podcast. Heroes.
Oh, oof.
Oh, he nearly said an expletive.
What was the expletive for?
It was because it was so awesome. I loved it.
Ah. Yeah. Yes. Heroes. In case you don't know about it, then obviously you've been living under a rock. And if you have been living under a rock, then obviously you don't watch television, so therefore it won't really care to you.
You can get television under rocks these days.
Can you?
Flat screen. Sorry.
Oh, that was a terrible joke.
Yes.
Essentially, it's superheroes in life.
Yeah.
It's a comic book made real, people. Come on.
I can't really explain it without
Is it like the X-Men?
No, it's better. No.
It's more like Unbreakable.
Yeah, it's people who gain powers but somehow retain their old lives and have to live.
It's old school TV from the Sci-Fi Channel, but with budget.
It's fantastic, isn't it?
It's great.
I actually had a discussion with my girlfriend about Sci-Fi Channel, of course, picked up Heroes first.
Good on them.
But we were looking back and thinking, what was the last series that Sci-Fi picked up as an exclusive that actually turned out to be quite good?
It did Firefly for a while.
Yeah.
That's true, it did do Firefly.
And they did. They were the first channel to do Ultraviolet as well, and I loved that.
No, Ultraviolet was Channel 4.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, they definitely. Sci-Fi have definitely played it since.
Yes, we're talking exclusives
here. Yes, okay.
Things where it came up one channel first. apart from Firefly, which Sci-Fi apparently did really badly.
Oh, terribly.
In America, most definitely. They skipped the first episode. They did all sorts of crazy stuff. They shifted it to like 3:30 in the morning before canning it altogether.
Oh.
And only showed the first episode after the series had finished.
Yes.
But I don't know what was the case in the UK. We could think of a single Sci-Fi series that was exclusive on Sci-Fi before being popular.
Did they get them from Babylon 5 at all?
Yeah.
Babylon 5 was Channel 4 first.
Yeah, they won.
Oh yeah, Big
Actually,
Breakfast.
Babylon 5 might be Sky 1 first, and then Channel 4, and then... Because we realised that Sky 1 actually did have quite a lot of exclusives.
I still haven't forgiven Channel 4 for how they handled the ending of Series 5, the culmination of the Shadow War. Through Big Breakfast, in installments of 15 minutes at a time, and I could only ever watch the two beginning segments because I had to go to school! You bastard! Channel 4! Sorry.
So what, rather than, you know, showing it in the evening like any sane people...
No, they showed it...
They did! At about 2 in the morning.
Ah. Yeah. So not exactly prime time.
No.
Not for school kids, anyway.
By no stretch of the imagination is 2 in the morning prime time for anybody.
Post-pub students.
Yes.
Still not prime time.
It's prime time post-pub students.
Although for sci-fi,
fair enough. You think, you're forgetting, it's exactly the right time to show Babylon 5.
Yes.
That's true.
Right, and as for my hating, it has to be Microsoft Access 2000.
Really?
It could be any variation upon that. As in 2003. But the one I'm particularly using at the moment is 2000.
Okay.
The reason why I hate it is because I'm at work, I'm currently having to build a database for events.
Mm.
Now, the problem lies in the fact that nothing in it is easy. It crashes half the time, and sometimes says, ooh, we cannot understand the jet engine. Which, of course, you know... As somebody who knows what they're doing, they understand that the jet engine is what is behind Access. But for the common layman, I'm not entirely certain what they're supposed to do about it.
Up British Aerospace?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Ask for some manuals.
Actually, I found an incredible bug in it, which is that if you try and create a form, it might be in a report, but I can't remember which one it was, and then try and name it the same name as another form you got it, but in the kind of wizard thing. Go over to the end, click finish, it comes up with a little box saying available fields.
How useful.
And then an OK button.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece of software. I've been paid money to use it before, but I don't think I ever will again unless I'm offered a lot.
Well, yeah, just the whole error message. It's very similar to Printer on Firecode. You can't understand Jet Engine. It's just another one of those things that I want to put into a list of things that should have been on the Terry Pratchett first ever computer, like out of cheese error.
Yeah.
Things like that.
Makes just as much sense anyway, doesn't it?
From Rido of Start.
See, my favourite along those lines were the comments in the Sun network drivers in the Linux kernel. They had one called the Big Mac, and Mac as in some kind of networking thing. I don't know if it's Mac addresses or something.
Probably.
No. Networking isn't my strong point. But they follow this up with, you know, the next generation network card, the Happy Meal. So the comments are all along the lines of, would you like fries with that? As it's going through the steps of making a connection.
It's better than Synac anyway, isn't it?
Anyway, Dan, what have you been loving and hating?
Well, as I've just started a new job, I haven't actually had much time for loving or hating. But I have... had an opportunity to do some cooking. Now, not great cooking. Hush you.
So it's now become cooking and eating.
Yes. My mother, bless her soul, has bought me a cookery book every year since I've been a student.
You still haven't taken the
She
hint.
Lives in hope.
Sorry. The latest edition has been Jamie Oliver's How to Cook, which is an absolutely blooming amazing book. I know it's all very Jamie Oliver and all very hyped and stuff like that, but it's absolutely fantastic if you want to get beyond beans on toast,
yeah.
But are not quite at lobster thermidor yet. It's a lot of good recipes that are easy to make, and there's a big freaking chapter at the back on how to slice things and things like that. It's a fantastic book, and I thoroughly recommend you check it out.
I do want Jamie Oliver to do an anarchist cookbook. He's just, oh, bung it in there. Oh, no, that was a bit too rough.
But I've been listening to quite a lot of radio going back and forth to my place of work, and Scott Mills does a thing where it's innuendo bingo. Yeah. Essentially, finding innuendo in media culture.
Yes.
And apparently, Jamie Oliver's series has some great bits in it.
Oh, tons.
Like, right, I've got to grab me balls, I've got to chuck them in this pan of frying fat. Oh! I've got to get my balls out because it's starting to simmer, and it just goes on like that. You go, why? Why?
I remember last week's one. It was Jon Snow, and he's reporting at the Chelsea Flower Show, I think it was, a few years back. He says, oh, I think I see him over there grinning rather widely. Yes, he's coming in his shorts now. Yes. Brilliant.
For primetime radio, definitely.
Anyway, Dan, you're concerned.
Yes, anyway. If you want to buy the book for some low-grade smut or for some actual food, I recommend it. Profits go to charity, so you don't even have to feel that capitalist about it. Moving on to hatings, a big part of my job at the moment is designing websites, which means I get to fight with the rigors of CSS and XHTML on a daily basis, which is fine in theory. I can build some very pretty stuff. The problem is that we have to support, for our software, not only Firefox and Safari and Opera 9 and IE7, but also IE6 and IE5.5 as well. Now, it is not...
How about Netscape 2? Do you still support that, or have they, given up on it?
The ironic thing is that on our machines are not only those browsers, but also IE5, but 4 and 3 as well. And you just think, why? It's a lot of fun trying to get one layout to work across all those browsers. So I'm hating the myth that is standards compliance at the moment.
Just for your personal edification, just look up the browser specifications for compatibility on these things. You might understand what kind of hunt he is having right now.
It's horrific, trust me. Anyway, lots of ranting there. Shall we move on to something related vaguely to what we're supposed to be here and talking about? We'll start with Ben.
My news article for this evening is the fact that SCO has been shown never to actually have owned the copyright of Unix.
Yay!
Happy dance.
Sorry.
This is only one of the lawsuits that SCO is involved in, but it's kind of a major one. SCO versus Novell, where SCO, I believe, sued Novell for claiming that Novell owned Unix.
Which is ridiculous because everyone already knows Novell kind of owns Unix.
It was sold to Novell in the early 90s by AT&T, when AT&T were giving up on the software business. And AT&T, Novell apparently licensed it to SCO, but didn't sell it to SCO. SCO have been claiming that they owned it and that Novell sold it. Novell came along a few years back during the, fiasco surrounding SCO suing everybody. Novell say, actually, we own Unix, so SCO promptly sued them to say, no, you don't. Except, apparently, yes, they do.
Nice. I'm actually quite impressed that a lawsuit like this went on for such a long period of time. Mm. But I suppose it's perfect proof about how the American law system works in regards to money.
Yes.
Essentially, as long as they can say, oh, but we have a new bit of evidence here, which gets thrown out of court. Oh, we've got a new bit of evidence here, which gets thrown out of court. Oh, we've got a new bit of evidence here, thrown out of court. And it goes on like this until eventually they run out.
Someone runs out of money.
Interestingly, I wonder how geeky the judge was on the court case before the case and after the case.
Maybe there should be like an investigation of that.
Yes. Covert ops.
Apparently the agreement was basically that Mavell retained ownership, but SCO was given the right to sell licenses, and SCO would keep 5% of the royalties.
So it technically means that Novell has 95% of those royalties.
And now SCO need to pay that 95% back.
Which is a problem given that SCO is now three lawyers living in a box in Florida.
Apparently they've, I spot today, their stock price has dropped 70%.
Let's see, Microsoft paid SCO approximately $16 million for what they claimed was license rights. Sun paid approximately $10 million. SCO didn't pay the fees to Novell, which gave its, according to the judge, gave SCO its first profitable year in history. So, basically, SCO are buggered.
Mm. Yeah. But then again, looking back on it, we already knew this.
Well, yes.
We knew for a fact that SCO was not going to win this case, and that essentially when they did lose, they would have no money left.
They were trying to...
Even if they did win, they would still have no money left.
They were trying to climb mountains with bananas, in my opinion. You know, counting...
That's a weird analogy.
Yes, sorry. It works.
Well,
you can't expect a banana to support your full weight.
Yes, but you can't climb half a mountain with bananas. So it's really not a very good analogy at all.
I'll work on it.
Now,
yes, come back to us at the end of the show.
Now, bear in mind that all SCO's other lawsuits, SCO versus IBM and whatever else, are based on the fact that SCO owns the copyright. So can't sue for copyright infringement of something that they don't own the copyright of.
Yes. So essentially, what
SCO have no right to be taking part in any of these lawsuits. It's not their property.
Yeah. Now it's their lawyer's job to find a bit of evidence that proves otherwise.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they can. I don't know if there's a reason they can't appeal. I don't know the US legal system, but. You know, basically, they're fucked.
Well, I think it's an interesting study of what happens to a tech company when they suddenly realise they don't have any tech anymore.
They barely have any company, for fuck's sake.
I mean, it sounds pretty funny, but there were a number of companies in this kind of situation after the dot-com crash and things like that, and a lot of IP moved around, and there were something like three big companies who actually had anything left. Mm. But lots of the few people left around who had some money but didn't know what to do with it. And some of them did go down the whole sue everybody route, but none of them got very far. It's almost as if SCO are kind of the last remnants of a long time ago. Ironically, fighting over Unix, which is what, how many years old now? 30 odd? 40?
37.
37 years old.
I'm surprised you know that figure straight out that little noodle of yours.
1970 to 2007 is 37.
That's a very good point.
Well, 1969, technically. But...
Yes, because the clock, of course, didn't start on them.
Actually, it didn't start in 1970. It kind of got restarted several times over the first few years.
And we're losing 60% of the listeners. No, carry on.
We're down to one listener. No! Right.
Don't leave! We love you!
Anyway... Let's move on to something we can actually discuss beyond SCO's fucked. Rich, tell me you have something we can talk about.
Okay, but first I want to put a small disclaimer on this one. Yes, Skippy, I did see your email, but no, I did not get your story from it. I got this story from it 4 hours prior to your email. Don't blame me that you've been on the Ubuntu mailing list. So therefore, Skippy, just tune out because you already know all of this story. Anyway.
No, keep listening. We love you, really.
Yes.
If you don't know who Skippy is, don't
Never
worry.
Mind.
If you're someone called Skippy who doesn't actually know us, we're talking to you.
Especially the owner of Skippy.com.
Yeah.
You're doing a service.
And Skippy.eu.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, go for it.
Anyway,
Rich.
This is from the pages of the Tokyo Linux Users Group. Shockingly enough.
That famous group.
It's famous.
It's famous in Tokyo among Linux users.
I suppose so.
But anyway, this is a article called Windows is Free.
Yeah.
Essentially, this is a commentary done by Dave Guthridge on something he read on ZDNet by another guy about how why people won't change from an operating system such as Windows or macOS to a free one, like Linux.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, what it boils down to is that users aren't dissatisfied with Windows. There's too many different versions of Linux. That people want the certainty that hardware and software will work. And that the command line has gone the way of the dinosaur. And that Linux is still too geeky. Now, essentially, this guy says that he agrees to the first 2 points, but hardware support, a bit of a rough moral ground there. Well, sorry, not moral. He's standing on rough ground with that statement. The command line statement, completely not nonsensical nowadays. You can easily use Linux, you can easily use Ubuntu at least, without looking at the command line.
Unless you're Ben.
Unless, but that's, you know, you don't have to.
You don't have to. I continue to not understand what's so easy about clicking buttons, but...
The fact is that, you know...
Most people are visually oriented rather than code structured.
it's actually perfectly true. That there is quite a lot of perfectly good psychological reasons why graphical user interfaces are better than command line interfaces.
Put it like this, it's the reason why television has succeeded over books. Ha! I am so intellectual.
Yes, Linux is still too geeky. What a ridiculous statement. I mean, it's that Windows is geeky, but the problem is that Windows is obsessed with hiding all the geekiness and making it incredibly broken in the process.
Well, their main market they're trying to go to is families. That way, they infect the whole world. You know.
But the issue lies in the statement it boils down to is that the reason why it's unlikely that people switch from Windows to Linux is that in the consumer's mind, Windows is free. macOS is free. Because when they buy a computer, it comes with it. The fact is you don't see a payment towards an operating system.
It's just a computer.
So even as a computer with an operating system on it, you didn't pay for the operating system.
You paid for the computer.
You paid for the computer, and the operating system came free with it. So from a consumer standpoint, what's the difference between Windows and Linux, apart from that you can download Linux for nothing, or get it sent to you?
In theory, you can do that with Windows. You're not meant to, but enough people do.
Yeah.
Essentially, you don't feel the sting.
The issue lies in that where the many people who actually bother to buy Windows, and who would buy a full-blown copy of Windows without thinking to themselves, should I get a new computer for that price?
Yeah.
Is that many of those people will just simply find a way of getting it for free. They're students who can get it from from their university. Like our tech departments. That's one good reason to go to the University of Plymouth, and probably many universities, is the fact that you can get free Microsoft software.
Anyone under the MSDNA?
Yes. Oh, sorry. It applies mostly to just to people who are under the Faculty of Technology.
Mm.
But the second thing is that most people who are willing to reinstall Windows either already own a copy of Windows, or they don't really care too much and would prefer to just download a cracked copy.
Mm.
Or get a key from somebody else. I mean, Vista, fine, you have to
jump through hoops.
Yeah, you have to jump through hoops to get to it, but the fact is, it all boils down to anyone who actually wants to upgrade will either buy a new computer or get a cracked copy. Because nobody will pay the stupid price.
Depending on for £400 for Vista Ultimate.
Interestingly, if you're right, and most people are going to either get a new computer or get a crack copy. Think about all the patches that Vista actually needs. The cracked copies are not going to last long.
No.
arguably, but this is going to be... That's a very good point, and in some ways could be the downfall of the whole system. It's certainly a major problem with Windows XP if you don't get the updates. If you have a properly updated copy of Windows XP and you look after it, it can be very secure and easy to use and without problems. The problem is the people don't. People don't know how to look after it. People don't download security updates and things like that.
And they download email viruses.
Well, yes, I mean, there is that, but at the end of the day, if the computer was sufficiently protected, arguably, it wouldn't be so much of a problem.
Yeah.
But if people are going down the Vista route, where you're actually actively blocked from downloading certain updates unless you have a legal copy, then you could be putting out into the wild a load of crap copies of Vista, which are maybe not buggy, but they're unsafe, thereby creating an even... reinforcing Windows' reputation for shittiness.
Yay.
It isn't really so much underneath, the simple fact is that because there are so many dodgy copies out there, you're actually creating a bad reputation for the company.
Yeah. Mm.
Now, this is one of the reasons why Microsoft fights so hard to stop people pirating it. Not because they don't want to give it away free. When you buy an OEM copy, it's massively reduced in price.
Mm.
Money's not the entire thing about it. It's about reputation of the company.
Mm.
Similar to Mozilla trying to stop people using the Mozilla name for...
Exactly. If you take the Mozilla name and build your own version of Firefox...
Take the name in vain.
Yeah, but it's full of holes and actually downloads bad software into your PC... then that bad reputation is permanently attached to the name, and you're screwed. I mean, this is one of the reasons why brand power is fought over so strongly, not only in the computing world, but all over, all brands.
I think that Linux is likely... Vista's been out a while now, but I do think that Linux is going to... Well, GNU Linux is going to catch up due to... just the massive change that Vista requires.
Well,
there's the whole... Just looking at the new version of Office, there's complete change in layout. Everything's moved. People need to try and work out where things are. I know otherwise intelligent people have spent half an hour trying and failing to find a spell checker.
There is a perfectly good rant regarding Office 2007 and how bad it can be for people in a standard Office environment to use. On Philip M. Jackson's website, he's a webcomic maker, his website is collectivecurios.com, he also does sequential art.
Don't read it, your brain will go out your ears.
Your brain will not go out your ears, you lie.
The thing is, the standard, well, I say standard, it's a de facto standard layout with the, you know, file, edit, view, etc. along the top.
Mm-hmm.
A standard put there by Microsoft themselves.
It's been around for at least 20 years. DOS applications look like that. Windows applications. Mac OS applications look like that, with the slight distance of having the bar across the top of the screen rather than the top of the window. Everything looks like that, except for Office 2007. And everything has moved. Where do you find things? If something's not got an icon there, where do you find... things that don't have an icon there.
The biggest problem with Office 2007 is not the fact that it's not easy to use. Mm. The fact is, if you're just writing, doing your standard things with Office, it's perfectly sensible. Because, you know, all fonts are in the right place, etc., etc. The problem lies in when you want to do the more complicated things, the things which you don't... that the person who just looks at the front end and just types a letter and then goes, save, print, done, wants to do. Things like all the formatting stuff.
Yeah.
Apart from the really easy stuff, is much more difficult to find than if you're used to old, especially if you're used to older versions.
Obviously, Microsoft have taken the policy of make the easy things easy and the hard things impossible.
Mm. I have heard the theory that the 2007 Office Suite isn't actually an Office Suite. It's just a psyops exercise by the CIA just to destroy people's minds.
Well, I think a lot of the argument goes, and this is going to sound like it's in defence of Microsoft, which is fair enough.
Traitor.
We may have been used to this file, edit, etc., etc., etc. paradigm for a long time, as you say, 20-odd years. But there are other ways of doing things, and Microsoft are just trying out a different way. One that is, if you know how to use it, a more visual way, and in theory, more intuitive. The problem comes that we're not used to this paradigm shift. Now, for us, it's almost impossible because we're so indoctrinated in it. But to people who are just coming into the world of computing, who know bugger all about anything in the world of computing, if you're learning to use it that way, it's no more difficult than trying to use Office 2000 or whatever.
Yes, but you have millions of people who have learned how to use it the
old
way.
But if Microsoft are trying to make a stand for making their user interface better to use, and they're going to stick this in the long term, arguably they're training people to use computers in a more efficient way.
Curiously, are we arguing that there should be a standardised approach to menu systems on certain applications?
Hell no. If you, I mean, there is a kind of vague standard. I mean, everyone has a file menu, an edit menu, a view menu, a help menu, etc., etc., etc. But there's no reason to say that's the best method. If you try and standardise something like that, you'd get locked in a loop and screwed.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't a protocol we're talking about here. This is a user interface. Now, you should stick with paradigms, but you shouldn't stick with ones that kick you in the balls.
Yeah. The biggest issue I have regarding Office, one is the fact that, yes, they're trying to make it easy to use, but the problem is that Office doesn't look anything like Vista.
No, that's true.
And the thing is that's what Microsoft are trying to say. Look, Vista, completely different style. So therefore, trying to introduce you to new themes. But then Office is another different style, and it's dragging people apart. The second thing is I've got to point this one out. Microsoft are trying to make this simple, right? The last time Microsoft fiddled with Office to try and make things simple, they invented Clippy. And you know where that went?
Well, the thing about Clippy is this is a long-standing argument. Everyone complained about that bloody paperclip, and then we all switched it off and carried on working with it. When I downloaded and started using OpenOffice, I had no paperclip, and I could see where everything was, but it took so goddamn long to do anything, I immediately got rid of it and started using Word again. At the end of the day, it may have been a mistake, but it wasn't one that actually killed the deal for me. Arguably, Microsoft haven't made a major mistake, apart from just being cocks, for quite a while.
Interestingly, the default help agent on my HP, licensed office suite was the dog, the little puppy thing.
That bloody dog.
Yes, but I got rid of him as well, but yeah.
The whole Windows situation is a lot of fun to talk about, especially when you've got a room of geeks like this. You've got one Linux user, one Mac user, one Windows user, and an AV geek in the corner who doesn't really count. He doesn't have a laptop, he has a board with some knobs on it.
I like fiddling with knobs! Is that such a crime?
Not since 1967.
Good year quote, though.
you just have a way with numbers, I think.
Yeah.
there was a thing a few weeks back about 40 years since the legalisation of homosexuality in the UK, which is the only reason I know. Yeah. Honest.
Anyway, wandering back onto the subject, PC Pro, which is one of the leading business PC magazines, has on the front cover, I think it's this month, I'm not quite sure which month it is, but I saw it in Tesco last week, thought it was important. A Cluedo type affair, which is who's killing Microsoft?
Nice.
Essentially putting Bill Gates, who of course is leaving Microsoft CEO status this year.
He is retiring. Yes. Lucky bastard.
To go off and actually do proper things with his money, like give it to charity.
Hooray.
As in, yes, I know that the Bill Gates Foundation has given lots of money to charity already, but anyway. So yeah, Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Linus, obviously, and...
all walk into a bar, sorry.
And I can't remember which one of Google they had on the front cover, but one of them. Because there's rumours about a Google-os. At the moment, what you've got is the Google Pack.
Yeah.
Which is probably as close as anyone's going to get.
I can imagine Google investing buying up a load of developers from Linux to do a Linuxy thing, maybe.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I can imagine that Google might go, I quite like Ubuntu. Let's make a derivative. And it all going downhill from there.
You know what it's going to be called, though? Googleplex, I'm sure.
But anyway, there's going to be, I think there's going to be some fairly major ripples in the next few years, especially with the whole paradigm shift on...
The problem is we've been saying that every year for the past 5 years.
Yes,
I'm sure people have been saying it every year for the past 40 years.
The difference this year to previous years is the fact that Dell, one of the biggest PC manufacturers, has started shipping machines for less money than for the Windows versions.
Apparently Lenovo are due to start shipping them as well.
Oh, the Chinese.
Yeah.
Acer coming.
Said they were, but then they said they weren't. But essentially, Acer what used shipped. To happen in the past... is that when you wanted the computer without Windows installed, because that was really the only option, you actually had to pay more money than you had for having one with Windows installed because of a incentive deal set up by Microsoft where they would reduce the cost of a computer, as in sort of give a little bit of a grant to put Windows on machines. I've got a feeling that this might have actually been thrown out at some point.
Worryingly, Dan has just come to the table with a tub of cream to rub into his arms at us.
Yes, he's currently lubricating his elbows.
Yeah.
My skin's falling off, so sue me.
I thought he was going to say his joints were seizing up. He's just like, you. Anyway, back to the main.
Alas, story. I couldn't think of a way of making my computer make these so sue me noise.
Well, it's in people's hearts and minds now, so thank you.
Can we technically say Dan just creamed himself?
No.
No.
I think, you know, creamed is a perfectly...
good verb.
It's perfectly accurate.
Can we step away from my bodily functions, please?
Yes, everyone knows that the term is lube, not cream. So Dan lubed himself up.
Oh, I need to lie down. Okay.
You can borrow my lube if you want it.
Ooh, slippery.
Makes it all smooth and shiny.
Okay, let's...
Yes, but what are you going to do with your lube, Malbosa?
Anyway. Well, it's one that's been raging for so long, it almost has lost meaning now.
Please excuse us, we're just going to roll Chris up in the carpet and chuck him out the window.
I think it is, I was going to say, it is vitally important that Dell are marking that they're shipping quite a lot of machines with Ubuntu on. And that other companies are getting on the bandwagon.
Yeah.
I think that, unlike in previous years, where we've said that Linux will take over the world, which is a complete baloney, because Linux was certainly not ready for prime time.
Well, I think a lot of the problem Linux has had is that it doesn't have a big commercial backer to force it into the public domain. We have Red Hat and Naval, etc., 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 who don't really give a flying toss about your average desktop user. Dell is the first company to actually put some effort into it.
I apologise, I think it does.
My God, people, how old are you?
You're saying...
you're right, the Dell thing is important because it does mean we've got something resembling a force behind it. Whether the operating system... and the various bits and bobs, and to a certain extent, I think the culture around it is ready for prime time, is a different matter. Personally, I don't think it is, but that's just me.
I think that still the debate lies in the fact of too many cooks. When it comes to Linux, there is far too many distributions out there.
It's not something we'd ever be able to solve because that is something that's core to Linux in itself.
Exactly.
The nature of the beast.
Yeah.
And unless there is one that stands out over all the others.
Which arguably Ubuntu is, not because it's the best, but because, again, it has a driving force.
It's certainly caught up very, very quickly with all the all the what I would claim are the core distributors. But I think that something.
I think the three main things that keep it going is the fact that it's a live distro, and it, I think it always will be. Then it got advertised even in like shop door windows. I saw one in
shop door windows.
Shop, yeah. Well, it wasn't a shop window. It was a shop door window.
It was a door specific. Shop window.
Yes.
It was a window door shop.
So it was actually advertising itself a little bit.
Yeah.
And the third one is the fact that it is easy to use. It is a point-and-click adventure game for anyone who wants to adventure outside of Microsoft land.
I'm just going to plug something here. In case you're interested in downloading Ubuntu and wishing to have a try on it on your own machine, why not visit mirror.termsoc.org for all your mirroring distribution needs.
Now, to move things on, it's a good mirror as well. I recommend it. It's kept pretty up to date. Now, just as we've been really, really up about Ubuntu, I'd like to, smash the bits, really, with a news story that was, today? A couple of days ago? Whenever it was. When it was revealed, rather unceremoniously, that the 8 servers that are maintained by the community for the serving of Ubuntu and that maintain all the Ubuntu websites were found to be horrifically badly managed, to the extent that they had been discovered that they had been hacked, and the fact that you could easily get shell access on them if you had even a modicum of skill. I find it, to be honest, hilarious. They've actually had to bring down 5 of the 8 servers. I believe at this point there is still only 1 left still to bring back up. But there's some of the hilarious things that they've done here. For example, they've been incredibly badly set up. Lots of web services running on each one, things you don't need. Classic security mistake. The version of Ubuntu they were using was completely unsupported. They were using Breezy Badger, which is, how many years ago?
I don't even know.
A couple, if not more. It's certainly not even in the long-term support program. And these are the core servers that serve the community editions.
These are clever blokes.
They're
most likely all professional sysadmins and whatever doing this. It's not as if Ubuntu doesn't have access to skilled people who are perfectly happy to do this for nothing.
I suppose the issue lies in the fact that nobody really paid attention to it. The thing is that they were set up many years ago, and they worked, and because they worked, no one was really noticing that much.
Change comes when change happens.
Yeah.
It didn't break down, so it wasn't updated.
And essentially, nobody would want to go, ooh, we better update all our servers. We better bring them all down, fix them, and bring them all back up again.
I mean,
because people would say that was mad.
I mean, like the Termsoc servers, I've noticed that most of the update work happens shortly after, or incidentally, shortly before most crashes.
What are you trying to say?
Yes. I'm not a Termsoc member anymore. You can't hit me.
Snap!
You're an honorary member. We'll make things. And I'm your sysadmin.
Yeah.
I own your server.
Yeah, when the internet went down the other day, where were you? In the cinema, I believe. Anyway, that's another point. The point I wanted to make is that, problems happen with servers like this all the time. The Termsoc servers, I mean, when I've been an admin, there have been major problems with them. We fix them.
Yeah, blackouts in Tokyo. We don't know how.
The problem is that Ubuntu is a company that Canonical are a company that are desperately trying to find recognition. They're trying to find new clients in places, and they're trying to spread the word of Linux in the best way possible, as we've just heard.
Mm.
The problem is, if they're going to be associated with such terrible server admin practices, this is another case of a complete loss of reputation.
Mm.
Now, this bit of news didn't travel far, and there wasn't actually damage done, but the very fact that they've come out and said that we have zero process for managing our servers, we don't even think about, we use FTP to move stuff around, we don't even have any kind of secure protocols, and it's a joke. I mean, it's nice to see that, John O'Bacon and James Troop, various important people who run the community side, at Canonical. They're coming up with a proper policy now for the managing of servers. And as Chris said, these things always happen just after we have a major cock-up.
The thing is, though, for start, I'm fairly certain James Troop is also one of the Debian sysadmins, or at least he was in the last few years when I've been taking notice. And Debian has had a policy for this for years, so, you know, a lot of the core Ubuntu guys and girls are Debian people as well, so why not just, you know,
do it?
But I suppose the whole thing is that if the servers did fall down, which they could happen under an attack, there is another 50 servers to back it up.
Well,
including our home. Mm-hmm.
That's true, but at the end of the day, it's not the damage done by the servers or the damage done to the servers, it's the damage...
It's the damage to their reputation.
Exactly, yeah. And I think this is one of the reasons why Canonical, the guys who actually are employed by it and do some hard work, all under the command of Mark Shuttleworth, have basically issued an ultimatum. You've got two choices. You can either sort yourself out and get yourself on proper hosting, or we're putting it on our own sponsored hosting, actually run by Canonical. It's nice to see that they're actually pulling their thumb out and doing something about it, but arguably this is something that should have been sorted out from day one. I mean, having a community-run thing is all well and good, but if it's not supported by a decent process and some people who know what they're doing, it's useless and can cause a lot of damage. Now, I love Ubuntu, and I really want to see it go far, but things like this are not doing good for them.
No. The biggest problem is they appear to have treated the servers like I saw people in the past of Termasoft use our servers. Essentially, you don't get paid for it, so therefore why should you care? And I think that's the biggest stumbling block, is that if you're not employed to look after it, then you won't pay a huge amount of attention to it.
But it rather defeats the
point.
I mean,
for example, you were saying the guy who also works on the Debian servers. That means that he's splitting his load between multiple people. You know, multiple things. I think that's what happens in the community. It's that you get people sharing the load of their work between multiple distributions and also their full-time job.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be difficult to keep security problems away from servers.
I would argue this is one of the biggest things that keep Linux out of business and keep Linux out of the desktop, is that the support is terrible, and at the end of the day you've got no guarantees that the code you're about to run is any good. The people who wrote it are doing this in their spare time for other people, you know, without any kind of real process. Now, of course, there are some fantastic software projects out there, and I would never dissuade anyone for trying anything open source, but at the end of the day, who are you going to go with to run your database server? Is it going to be someone who's got a big reputation, has a lot of commercial support, and can really get you going? Or is it something that has been knocked out?
Or is it a guy with a beard on the other side of the world?
Oh, well, beards are good, but yes. I mean, it's a big point.
Nothing against beards, I've got one. Sorry.
But to a certain extent, it's silly, though, really, because that may just be the impression that you've got one team that are big and commercial and proper, like Oracle. And then you've got another team that appear to be open source and fannying around and not doing it properly, like MySQL. Now, that was a news article that came out the other day, that MySQL are not closed sourcing, but shifting their source around a bit, so that for the latest versions, you can only get at it if you are an enterprise, i.e. commercial customer of MySQL.
Right.
Now, on the one hand, that is just an effort by MySQL to make more money. Fair enough, money's money. But on the other hand, it's trying to get more people to get onto enterprise. The more people who are in enterprise, the better reputation MySQL has, beyond the cheap and fast thing that powers every spam-based website out there. Reputation is key.
So, the thing is, it kind of demonstrates what seems to be a common theme with the difference between Ubuntu and Debian. Debian always appears quite disorganised, but it's got a lot of policy and whatever, built up over 14 years now, of how to run things, and in general it works. Ubuntu, on the surface, appears to be very slick and professional and organised, but you get things like this every so often that crop up that kind of shatter that illusion, or at least shake it.
Well, I mean, recently there was that issue regarding Automatics, which supposedly was a plugin for Ubuntu that made life so much easier to use it, but in fact spent most of its time breaking everything and essentially destroying everything, your computer, and you had to reinstall.
You did have to be very careful as to what version you were using.
Exactly.
Right. The one that pisses me off is the kind of habits of some Ubuntu users of just collecting every software repository they can find and adding it to their sources.dot list just to get the latest possible version of whatever software is there.
But surely that's essentially the policy of Ubuntu, is that every release is the latest release, which they've then...
Yes, but I'm not talking the latest and greatest Ubuntu official repositories or whatever. I'm talking about some developer who set up his own repository to test things on more than one machine and make it easier for him, and to make it easier for maybe his beta testers or whatever, and who has no intention for this to be used publicly, but apparently it is by some crazy Italian bloke who thinks the world should use this highly unstable software.
But then again, that's being kind of ridiculous, because surely if you want, with Ubuntu, if you want to use the unstable software, you get it to use the unstable software, but that's not the default.
But it's
a bit like saying that somebody who downloads Debian and installs it on the machine will be forced to use all the unstable stuff.
I realise it's not like Ubuntu policy or anything, certainly.
You have to actually go out of your way to set it.
It's just a mindset that seems to be common among Ubuntu users, I'm sure among several other...
But the thing is, that's what pisses me off about Debian. The whole fact that if I want to have the latest version of, say, Amarok, for instance, which admittedly I have to use Kubuntu, I can't do that. I can't get that from the repository because Debian has to spend 3 months making sure it works properly before putting it in. And the fact is, I don't want to go and piss about trying to find it on the internet. If I can just go add new programs, oh look, the latest version of Amarok is released. They're done, lovely. That's the thing, it's removing my power for doing what I want to do. And that annoys me.
But do you get that with Ubuntu? Because surely there's only a new release every 6 months or whatever. Do you get the latest and greatest?
I can if I want to.
Yeah, the repositories are updated on an incredibly regular basis. Unlike the Debian repositories, which put stability over...
Well, no, because unstable is updated regularly, apart from when there's a release due. And unstable is not, you know, going to bugger your machine up if you use it. It's perfectly fine for everyday use.
But that's kind of where the problem lies, is that by sort of having it known as unstable,
you kind of instantly think that
it's like all alpha built.
Yeah, that's true. It's not a particularly good name, but...
But then again, it's posing itself at different people. With Debian, people want things that are stable. They want to faff about with everything. But the thing is that Ubuntu are aiming it at home users and people who want to use their computer like everyone else wants to use their computer.
Well, I'm sure...
Doing everything. So productivity stuff, as well as office stuff, as well as games. And the fact is that Debian kind of takes that joy away.
I think at the end of the day, the difference between Ubuntu and Debian is not a technical one. It is simply an astonishingly slight change in culture. A difference of what is important to a Debian user and what is important to an Ubuntu user.
There is such differentiation among geeks.
Yes, well, it's not even geeks to be, it's just how people look at things. But I think the most astonishing thing is how fast the rise of Ubuntu has been, despite the fact that it's so young, and it's such a slight cultural shift, that maybe it's this cultural shift that's kicking Linux into the forefront of people's minds. The fact that they're placing ease of use and a standard as being a higher priority than long-term stability and lots of testing and the general pervasiveness of Debian. They want something that's contained and happy. Like, as we're going right back to the beginning of the podcast, when you buy a PC, it comes with an operating system. Bidish-bosh. That's what Ubuntu can be.
Yeah.
Hence it being installed on Dells. I don't think there's a chance. I think it's all about this tiny cultural difference. And until we understand the differences in these distributions of Linux, we're never going to stop arguing about which one's better. I mean, we haven't stopped arguing about whether Windows or Linux is better, beyond technical reasons.
I think the next fracture in Linux will not be between people who don't like the way Novell are playing things and so on and so forth. The crack is going to appear between commercial and home. Because I think that, again, with the MySQL thing, about the whole trying to split it off to enterprise, I've got a feeling that there might be a break between the enterprise Linux users, sorry, the enterprise Linux providers and the home providers. That essentially, the people that there's going to be a few, what's the word? The best way to describe it is bombs being thrown over the hedge.
Well, I don't necessarily see that there does have to be a split.
Yeah.
Because...
But you hear the split going on now. Debian is more enterprise. Ubuntu is more home.
I wouldn't agree with that at all. For start, Ubuntu has a server edition. And Debian is perfectly usable on both desktops and servers.
Well, yes, but then so is Windows Server.
I think at the end of the day,
well then,
you can't sit there and say that Linux can be, in its Debian form, all things to all people. You're not going to get my granddad using Debian in the same way you are. In fact, he would go nuts if you tried to get him to use Debian. He would be using Ubuntu, if not desperately trying to get Windows back on his machine.
My point is not that, you know, everyone will want to have nothing but a few externs or whatever.
Well, no, the thing is you're missing the whole thing regarding enterprise versus home. Enterprise, everything is configurable. Essentially, you get a blank sheet which you have to put things on top of. Ubuntu is the opposite way around. Essentially,
you get a magazine,
and if you want, you can stick some more pages in it. You can take some pages out.
Returning back to Dan's previous point, it sounded like we should try and experiment. How about we install Linux onto his granddad's machine? Even a couple of manuals, just to help, and see what happens.
He'd kill me.
I'm sorry to flick back again to the first discussion. But something I didn't actually raise in it is that this guy who wrote the article, essentially his girlfriend, which is usually the regular debate, is the girlfriend who comes into the picture, has a laptop which kept blue screening on her. Of course, she was using Windows because that's where blue screens come from. And essentially, she went, "Can you fix it?" And he responded, "Yes, I can fix it. However, it will make it look different. It will look different." But apart from that, he didn't sort of indulge with any more information. And she's perfectly happy with it. The problem is that it's the fear. It's by trying to overcomplicate things and try and make things say that, oh yes, it's the same, but it's different, but it's something else. It's...
Food for thought.
Yeah.
It's an argument that's going to rage from now until the day.
It is. To be honest, it's going to rage until one of the companies burns. No, really. The only way that this will be solved is if either Microsoft, Apple, or Canonical go bust.
Nothing short of
Debian can't really go bust because they don't actually have any money.
Nothing short of an all-out war.
Oh, open source companies can go bust. They just disappear.
Yes. Well, actually, the CEO Linspire has apparently quit his job. Mm. Admittedly, the Microsoft FUD didn't help.
No. Linspire's.
FUD, for those who aren't technically minded, is fear, uncertainty, and doubt. It's a way of Microsoft to try and persuade people that their software was best, and they should do what they tell you to do.
It's an all-pervasive topic. American politics. Yeah. Look it up. Wikipedia.
Truth by consensus.
Truth because I say so.
I think we've whittled on for quite enough now.
Plenty of time. Anyway, we'll finish off, I think. But of course, without our regular feature, which makes no sense, but I find it thoroughly entertaining. Cups of tea. Now, Ben, what has been your brand of the last month or so?
I picked up a box of Clipper organic fair trade tea bags from Sainsbury's a few weeks ago. And they're rather nice. In fact, probably the nicest tea I've ever tasted.
So that's Clipper Fair Trade for Ben there. Rich?
Which particular variation of Clipper? Or is it the standard one?
I think it's just the bog standard Clipper tea. Also, I've got a jar of Clipper Fair Trade coffee. And that is also extremely nice. It's instant coffee, and it's not going to be amazing.
But it's not tea, so it's not has no place in this segment.
Meanwhile, I unfortunately have been still ploughing through the box of a label I've got on my shelf. Mm-hmm. It's still a very good tea. There's nothing particularly wrong with it at all.
I would say taking two. It's good.
But I would like to add to that that at work, my boss is quite a big laureate of fair trade products, and she's been indulging me in the Tradecraft double chocolate cookie.
Ooh.
It's tough. I mean, it's not tough like a chewy. It's kind of, it's a harder cookie than you usually expect, but it's quite nice to dunk. And in fact, it's actually best to rest it on the side of your mug. And that way it doesn't go mushy like it would do if you dunked it, but instead just softens up a bit like a Millie's cookie. It's quite nice, but as I said, unfortunately it's not a tea, so...
There's technique to be had. I think there's a lot to be said.
A bit like Tim Tams, really.
Yes. Now, they're a story for another time.
Yeah.
Personally, I don't think you can beat a nice cup of black coffee with digestive biscuits.
It's a good choice.
I'd have to go...
Oh, God, we're getting onto biscuits now.
Yeah, sorry. I just have to say, custard cream, standard, cup of tea, standard, lovely.
Anyway, Dan, what have you been...
Biscuit or tea?
Start with tea.
We'll start with tea. Now, as I've started a new job and a new house, I've been partaking of two different kinds of tea.
We'll get you.
Now, at home, my housemate, Seth, is a Yorkshire tea drinker.
Yeah.
Now, I believe my... associates here don't think much of it, but...
Well, I must point out here, I come from Yorkshire, and it's most definitely not popular in my household.
Well, I don't have to say it is. I personally quite enjoy the taste.
I suppose actually, theoretically, I've never actually tried it in a soft water area, because York is very much a hard water. No. You know, you kind of pour out the water and come out as a block.
Yeah.
So maybe the problem is that I used regular Yorkshire tea back in the day when there was only just Yorkshire tea and didn't try the hard water variety, and equally I've not tried the Yorkshire tea down here.
Okay, for my other tea, at work there is a mysterious box marked... it is marked only as Normali, in which are tea bags, and I drank those for a couple of weeks, and it's an okay tea. I then, last week, found... the stationery cupboard, into which was secreted two incredibly huge bags of 1,600 tea bags each of PG dips. It's an okay tea, certainly not my favourite.
It's free.
It gets me through the working day. That's my tea choice.
Well, PG tips have got the best tea bag.
Oh no, this isn't even the fancy tea bags.
This isn't the fancy tea bags.
But there are 1,600 of them.
Yeah, but still.
Times two.
I think we should still go for the effort of putting them in pyramid bags, damn it.
The pyramid bags are good. I'm going to have to start bringing my own tea though, because PG Tips,
in this form anyway, certainly doesn't take the biscuit.
And as for me, I only had one, but I think I've been high ever since, so it's like 3 days ago. But I will have to say, it's not really a tea, they do call it a chai, and it's that chai latte from Starbucks. And it's just
oh, please, for the love of God, stop booing Starbucks. We don't care.
Yes. I only have it because it's gorgeous. It's cinnamon, it's creamy, and it's got full of sugar and caffeine, and it keeps you high all day. It's brilliant. I get jitters from it. You know?
I'm just going to raise a small rant here.
Yes.
Okay.
It's about Starbucks being fair trade,
no.
Bollocks.
No, I'm not going to even raise that. I'm going to raise the important fact that, fine, I don't care what you say about Starbucks, for the obvious reason that it's the only place where I can get a good cup of coffee in town. Costa, pile of crap. Carradine's, okay, but mostly shut.
That's true.
The fact is that Starbucks is the only place where the coffee actually tastes good.
Yeah.
Well, it's not my fault.
There's a coffee shop, I forget what it's called, it's upstairs in the new shopping centre in Plymouth, and they did me a very nice latte, but unfortunately I had to give them my firstborn son in order to purchase it. So it's not cheap in there.
What was that? A
long-term subscription.
Order. Yes.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
For one cup of coffee. Anyway, I think that just about rounds it up for tonight. It's been a long, ranty podcast with only three news stories.
And supposedly at the start, you should say, I'm sorry for this lovely short podcast we're having here.
Yet again,
to be fair, we have come in somewhat shorter than usual, but not all that much.
It is dark outside. Always a bad sign.
But it was dark outside when we started.
It wasn't when we got here. Anyway, that's enough. I'm going to say goodbye first this time, and then I'm going to secretly go for Chris.
Oh my God, what do I say? Goodbye. Goodbye?
Ben?
Is that it?
Goodbye.
Rich?
Goodbye.
And I'll see you next time on Login. Au revoir.
Goodbye.
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 Hit it, then.
Login was presented by Dan Kosser, Ben Ali, and Rich Jeffrey, and is a production of Termisoc, the University of Plymouth Computing Society. Okay.